The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program, WMKV, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or staff and management. The information and advice presented are educational in nature and not intended to be taken as specific legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Always consult with your own legal, accounting, or other professional before making any investment. Welcome to Real Life Real Estate Investing, a show to help you gain financial freedom by investing in real estate. Brought to you by the Real Estate Investors Association of Cincinnati and the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You're listening to Real Life Real Estate Investing on WMKV, WLHS, and the Maple Knoll Radio Network. And now your host, Vina Jones Cox.
All right. I am not Vina Jones Cox, but I am Scott Ellsworth. And I'm happy to be here. I'm a CPA, real estate investor. I'm going to be hosting this evening. And we have got a guest for you that you're just going to love. Before we get to that, I want to give the information so you guys can call in with questions or you can email with questions. So email is vinaradio@gmail.com. And you can call the station at 877-772-9658. And our guest tonight is Scott Myers. An expert in self-storage. I love listening to Scott. Listened to him for years, and he's an expert in this. Scott, how you doing?
I am doing fantastic, Scott. Good to be back with you again.
All right. So when callers get in, maybe you say, I'll assume if you say Scott, you want to talk to Scott Myers and not Scott Ellsworth. So two Scotts. Hey, Scott, so how did you ever get into self-storage investing?
Yeah, I think, you know, we all love real estate for the same reasons, and that is rental real estate, that is, and that is because of appreciation. You know, we can force that appreciation by buying these fixer-uppers and turning them around, and then you can do that with multifamily and other forms of commercial real estate by not only reducing expenses, but also by increasing income and then fixing them up and turning them around. And then we can depreciate those for tax purposes. We can borrow money to buy it, and then we put tenants in to pay down our basis. There is no other investment out there that compares to real estate. However, it's the tenants and toilets and trash that most people don't really care for too much. And so myself included. And so once we had a number of units, we had, we had about 76 houses and then 400 and some apartment units. And I just realized that I was growing, you know, less loving of my fellow man and woman, for that matter. And, you know, we just did not have the time, my wife and I, the time and the freedom that we thought. We got into a real estate that we were going to have, even though we had property management companies and managers handling things. At the end of the day, the buck stops here, and we still had to handle the problems. And it was just, you know, until you get to that place where, you know, there's a critical mass where you can really, you know, hire, you know, enough staff to, you know, move completely out of the business and then move everybody else into those roles. It was just taking its toll on us. And so we looked around the landscape, and, you know, there really isn't anything else in real estate besides parking lots that doesn't have tenants and toilets. And so I began looking into self-storage, which at the time, you know, this was 20 years ago when I began looking into it. And I think at that time, it was just kind of considered the, you know, the ugly duckling or the, you know, the Cinderella, the stepchild of commercial real estate. But once I began to look under the hood, I realized that this was the best performing real estate asset class, bar none, across the country by every measure, not just by opinion, but by all stats. And then I began to look into it a little bit more in my own market. And I saw the light, and I bought my first self-storage facility with a partner, and then bought several after that. And since then, we've never looked back. I sold up all my houses and apartments, and you know, now we have over 28,000 units nationwide, and we've got about 50 facilities that we have under management right now. And you know, we've approaching a little over 4 million square feet of self-storage that we have under management right now.
That's a lot.
And we just absolutely love the asset class.
So what in fact do you – what really stands out? Is it the no tenants, toilets, or trash? Or what do you love about this self-storage investment?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the main thing. It's also, I mean, there's a lot. I've got, you know, my top 10 reasons, which, Scott, you've heard several times if you've ever heard me speak or talk about the subject. And that is, you know, the fact that it is also very recession-resistant and also inflation-resistant. It's a simple, predictable business model. It's not an easy business. Don't I don't want anybody to think that this you can treat it just like a hobby or it's a set it and forget it or a mailbox business, because there is no such thing as a mailbox business. But it's a very simple, predictable business model with fewer moving parts. And, you know, when things go bad in the economy and we head into a recession, well, people downsize, businesses downsize, and they move their stuff into self-storage. When things are good in this country, what do? Well, we go out and buy more stuff. And so we outgrow our basement and our garage, and so things go into storage. And so for that reason, you know, it's very level. We don't have to play the curve, if you will, or the game and the ups and downs like we have in other forms of real estate. You know, it has the lowest loan default rate and the lowest loan loss rate because we're not susceptible to that. And when it comes to tenants and toilets, we don't have that. We just have customers who are storing their stuff instead. And when they don't pay, well, then we get to auction their stuff off. And we put an overlock on their unit, and depending upon what state you're in, after 60 or 90 days, we sell their stuff and we recoup our lost rent and late fees. So, you know, take your pick. It's just it's a very solid, simple, predictable business model that works very well in all economies. And the courts are on our side because we don't have to go into eviction courts or habitational real estate court. We have lien laws and we get to handle it ourselves. We are the judge and jury. And, you know, once we begin to operate in that mode in this asset class, we realize that, well, life's a little different over here, and we got excited about real estate again.
It is interesting because when you have multifamily, you've just got to deal with the individuals much more. I mean, obviously you have individuals coming in to the facility, but it's just not the same. I would think also that with the rent, like if I'm renting a one-bedroom apartment that's $1,500, If I'm renting a storage unit that's 100, it's a much easier.
It is.
You know, people are going to be able to pay that, and they're not going to get in a bind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a simpler relationship. It's a simpler transaction, and you know, the fewer the units that we have, since they're only 100 apiece. You know, I can fit 500-600 units on 4 acres, which there's quite a few. You know, quite a lot fewer properties that and units that you can put onto that in terms of single family houses or multifamily. And so as a percentage, if I lose one tenant in 100 square foot versus 1,000, well, you understand it. You get the math. It just doesn't make that much of an impact.
Right.
So
again,
it doesn't take a hit to the business model. There's just many, many reasons why we love the asset class.
It is. It is to not have to deal with those people living there would be just a dream. So, hey, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more to Scott. All right, we are back. Scott Ellsworth here with Scott Myers. Real quick, if you have any questions, you can email those to vinaradio@gmail.com or call the station at 877-772-9658. Did want to tell you about two upcoming events. One, on September 15th, there is going to be, Cincinnati REIA is going to put on a webinar called All the Ways to Finance Small Investment Properties, and we'll talk a little bit, Scott, about maybe some smaller facilities rather than very large ones. And then also, Scott is going to be a speaker. He's on tonight, obviously, but he's going to be a speaker at the National Real Estate Investing Summit that's brought to you by the Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. That's in Cincinnati, the Great Wolf Lodge. If you go to areaconvention.com, areaconvention.com, that is October 31st through the 3rd of November. And the other webinar, go to CincinnatiREIA.com, and you can register there. So, Scott, it sounds like a wonderful asset class to own, but I assume there's some challenges. So what are the biggest challenges around the self-storage asset class?
Yeah, I think, you know, that question is asked a lot. And I think where I see people get tripped up, you know, so we're investors. We also consult, and we have a mentoring arm as well and a mastermind. And the mistakes that we see people make over and over again aren't really anything that is really akin to or unique to self-storage. It's just that folks tend to assume that this is an easy business and an easy asset class, and they don't do their own due diligence. They don't get educated. And they make just some basic small business mistakes. I think they don't take the time to learn how to properly analyze and underwrite and do the financial analysis to determine that this thing is going to actually produce the amount of income that either a seller or a broker says. And then they don't put together a proper capital stack. And then they find themselves not earning the same, you know, the amount of money that they thought or even at a profit. And then from an operations standpoint, same thing. You know, if you were standing in front of a judge and hopefully not a judge and a jury, and pleading ignorance to breaking a law when it comes to selling off somebody's goods and not following the proper procedure or anything else that would land you in hot water, that doesn't apply either. So I think it's you need to understand what it means to own and operate a self-storage facility and deal within the laws and the lien laws and the confines of, you know, operating within that real estate asset class period. So you really need to know your stuff. You know, we don't have a whole lot of gotchas. There's just not a lot of liabilities because people don't live there. And so, you know, insurance really covers most of the gotchas, if you will. The place where people can get tripped up the most, but it happens the most infrequently, is if they do handle the sale of a unit improperly. Now, every state has lien laws, and you have to hit your marks. You have to send out certified letters. You have to give ample notice, and you have to follow a procedure, document. And if you do that incorrectly and the person comes back who owned that unit and says that, hey, I never got notice and you never actually sent notice or you never kept a record of that, or if they were in the military, which is a no-no because we cannot sell a unit if somebody has stated on their application that they're in the military because they could be deployed and we can't get a hold of them.
Wow.
And so there's just some ways that that you could get tripped up and people can get in a lot of trouble. Sometimes we have seen in the past where somebody sold, you know, unit number 101 when they were supposed to sell unit number 201. That's just negligence. But that's, you know, that goes within, you know, just the realm of any small business. So outside of that, it just, there's not anything unique to storage and where people get tripped up. They do so just by, you know, their own omission of education and making sure that they're doing the right things and, you know, crossing their T's and dotting their I's.
When I talk to clients who are interested in self-storage, I do, maybe you can address this. So I tell them it is a real estate play. You're buying real estate, mm-hmm. you're renting that mm-hmm. out, but it is a little bit different. A lot of the aspects mm-hmm. feel like a small business and not just I have rental property and people live there. So maybe expand on that a little bit. What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think self-storage is, in terms of the other real estate asset classes, even though, you know, the others and even multifamily and other forms of commercial real estate, you know, there's a rental arm to it and sure. a management. But self-storage seems to be deemed as being a little more operational heavy. And, you know, it isn't, other than the fact that there are just more units there. So there's a little bit more activity from that standpoint. Yes, it is real estate with an operating business layered on top of it. Now, you couldn't separate the two because, you know, it obviously right. goes with that with that form of real estate. But you would also notice that when many of these facilities are listed, one of our good hunting grounds for finding facilities is with small business brokers and on small business websites, and they're selling and listing these facilities. And that's because the mom and pop owners that have had them for a number of years, they recognize it more as a business than they do real estate. The SBA, the Small Business Administration, also has a very, very favorable loan structures for self-storage facilities because they deem it as more of a small business, and they don't have those same types of loans, those loan structures in place for any other form of real estate except for self-storage. And so, you know, in many ways, in many instances, you could say that, yeah, it's, I don't know if it's 50-50, 60-40, 40-60, but there is more of a business element on top of the real estate.
So I know when I go into those, I've seen them where, you know, they're doing everything. I mean, they're obviously renting units, but they're also, they seem to have other revenue streams. So what are those other revenue streams in the space?
Now, you know, you're hitting on, Scott, another one of my top 10 reasons why we love real estate, and that's because there are so many different ancillary income streams that you can add on to a self-storage facility. And you know, call it an income stream. It's just part of the operating side of the business, but that is charging a one-time non-refundable administration fee right out of the gate. We also have the ability not to sell insurance because you have to be licensed to do so, but offer it. And in some cases, many owners like ourselves, we offer a tenant protection program, and some of that is self-funded that we can also administer, which is it can be a profit center for us as well. You sell locks, boxes, and moving supplies, adding on, you know, rental trucks like U-Haul and Penske and Budget and some of the other companies out there. We offer eBay services. We offer pack and ship services. If you have boats and RVs, you can offer a propane exchange or even more like a concierge service. You know, there's a number of different ancillary income streams that you can add to a self-storage facility that just, you know, increase you know, the ticket price when they move in and while they're at the facility. You know, again, comparing and contrasting to other forms of real estate, you know, there's really, I mean, if we stretched it, we've identified over 40 different profit centers that you can add to a self-storage facility. So specialty storage for wine and furs and art and other collectibles. And we've seen dog washes being put into different units that are run, you know, with a kiosk. I mean, that's there are many, many, many ways to be able to monetize a storage facility rather than just renting space.
Yeah, and it seems like the customer base is very mm-hmm. wide-ranging. So we have a complete real estate portfolio, and we just had need for storage for mm-hmm. materials and tools that weren't used very often. Mm-hmm. So we as a business, we mm-hmm. were renting that space. It isn't just about individuals, is it?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. We certainly like the business clientele because they usually stay longer, and they usually rent up more space as their business grows. And it is a very cost-effective way of not having to go into a warehouse that when they have outgrown their garage as well, or a small shop that they may have, or the owner that has the big truck and or the truck and trailer that they can't park in their neighborhood because of the HOAs, they park them in our storage facilities. But we're seeing kind of a changing, if you will, of self-storage. Not only are people utilizing them as an extension of their small business or running a small business out of their facility. So they may, go to Starbucks or their own kitchen table or out of their truck and their laptop to do the business side of the business. But then the inventory side, the tool side, or the maker side, that's all handled within the storage unit. So we're adding some bigger spaces as we develop these facilities. Some of them now we're having either an office. Almost all of our facilities have an office up front with a conference room that can be rented out or just utilized by our clients. But now we're adding some offices and a warehouse in back. So some of our buildings will have a little component where it is more like a flex space with a larger warehouse in back. And as we see, Amazon coming into the neighborhoods and, the battle, if you will, or the opportunity that we see for that last mile distribution of all things that are delivered to the home, self-storage is very quickly filling in that gap. And so now we're developing facilities that have 500 to 1,000 square foot units in it to be able to accommodate the Amazons of the world and others.
That is definitely a new new twist on self-storage units, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The opportunities. Once again, you either build a building or add on to your home. It's far more expensive to do so than it is strictly to just rent it from a facility that's already been built.
And I have seen one facility rented one time had it was not even manned. It had a kiosk. Mm-hmm. So touch on that about the fact that you obviously I assume it depends on the size of your complex and your needs, but mm-hmm. but how does that work and the benefits of that?
Yeah, just a quick history lesson. We've evolved, quite a bit over the past 15 years or so when kiosks came into play in self-storage, just as they had been, at the gas pump and the grocery store and just the use of ATM machines. That storage is just a low labor intensive type of transaction. It's like renting a DVD, at the time where you pick out a unit. You're not shopping for a school system and checking out the neighborhood or your neighbors or anything. It's just you're renting a unit. You need a 10x10. To store your extra junk, your treasures. And so that's all you're just checking off the box, literally. And so you insert your driver's license, it uploads your information, the credit card, you pick a unit, and it gives you an access code to be able to get into the facility, and then you bring your own lock or they sell you one. So that was the big old machine that used to cost $18,000 to put in. Well, now all of that, if you think about it, can be done on a cell phone. Now we have a small little machine, a kiosk to sell the lock, but the rest of it, everything else is stored in and can be done by a phone or still now just a small kiosk, which is basically an iPad that's sitting on a stand inside of a small office within the facility, which is probably what you're referring to as the facility that you saw. And so, there's a couple different types of business models. You can either use that as an overflow and have that kiosk there, or the ability for somebody to rent a unit or reserve a unit online from their phone or an iPad or a laptop, or unmanned, in which that's the only way that they can rent a unit. And they do have the ability to, if they get stuck somewhere along the way or have a question, they can click on a button and they're immediately connected by way of video to a call center, where now we don't have to pay a manager full-time or even part-time to sit at the facility. But we have fractional managers that are sitting in a call center that are only utilized when needed. And so it's a one-to-many in terms of our payroll and reducing the cost. So we've allowed the technology that is available out there to be able to permeate self-storage, and we've just taken advantage of that to be able to reduce our payroll costs and make it more efficient for our folks to be able to rent a unit and pay and manage their stuff.
That is awesome. Do you generally find that... the other areas? I mean, I guess it depends on the size of the unit. Do you just have maintenance folks that you're hiring, subcontractors? Do you have people on payroll? What's a typical, I mean, obviously we talked about the call centers and renting and that mm-hmm. type of thing. What about the maintaining, cleaning mm-hmm. the units when they move mm-hmm. out, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, multiple ways of skinning that cat, and of course, you know, all of your questions, Scott, or anybody else's are, the answer is it depends, and it does. You know, if you've got one facility, then, you know, it may be you. If not, then, or from the get-go, you can hire somebody part-time. And, you know, there's every single city that we operate in and every single city that we've seen, there's somebody close by that operates out of a truck that services self-storage facilities, and they service all of them. They
great.
Know how to handle, you know, the gate software, the gate management and maintenance on those. They know how to replace the door springs and how to replace the doors, you know, and they have a truck full of stuff, parts,
right.
you know, for anything at a self-storage facility that may need. And they're either on call or they come by, you know, once a month, once every couple of weeks. And, you know, they fix a few broken items at this facility and then do their regular maintenance. And so it's just a service or just an individual and just another line item expense that, you know, that you handle. Same thing with cleaning and, you know, landscaping right. and lawn care. Sometimes we hire managers that are, you know, the jack of all, and we pay them to do some of the maintenance stuff either separately or on the side or in addition to their duties or with their duties. And other times it's just stuff farmed out. And then obviously as you grow, then you're going to have either staff or your own teams or then you're going to hire a company to handle it for you.
Awesome. All right, Scott, we're going to take another break. But just before we go to the break, remember, if you have questions, venaradio@gmail.com or 877-772-9658. We'll be back after this. All right, welcome back to Real Life Real Estate Investing. I'm Scott Ellsworth, your host, and we have got a guest, a great guest, Scott Myers. Self-storage is his expertise. And if you've been listening or if you just got on, you need to be taking notes. This is a great asset class, and Scott knows what he's talking about. You also need to get to the convention, the National Real Estate Summit, Investing Summit. That's in October. Scott's going to be speaking, and he's usually got a team of people there, and they'll answer questions even after he's done speaking. So really, really think you should attend that. So a listener has a question. This is from PK. What are the ideal locations for self-storage if you're starting ground up? That's his first. He's got three questions, but that's the first one. What's the ideal location mm-hmm. for self-storage if you're starting ground up?
Mm-hmm. Hey, PK, thanks for the question. And the ideal location is one in which there is growth in the market or that it is undersupplied with regards to competition. So, again, stating that self-storage is a simple, predictable business model that we start with anytime we're going to do a ground-up development. It starts with a feasibility study. And so you're going to hire a consultant to perform a feasibility study. And what the consultant will do is take a look at the site and draw a couple of rings around it, a 5-mile, a 3-mile, and a 1-mile. And they'll take a look at the competition, how many square feet they have, how many units. And then they're going to compare that against the demographics of the market, but most importantly, how many people there? What is the per capita? But then they're going to look at the income and the percentage of multifamily and the propensity to store items, you know, a number of different means by which we determine whether a market is good or not. But that is really the first place that we start. And then rental rates. We're going to look at rental rates as well. So once we have that information, then, you know, we plug it into our formulas and we determine how big of a facility that we can build on this site, how many units that is, what does it look like at 90%, 85 to 90% occupied at the rental rates in the market. And then we back that into the cost of building the facility and how long it'll take to lease it up. And voila, 4 hours later after underwriting, you'll have your answer as to whether that is something that is worthy of moving forward in or not.
Have you seen, for folks that opt not to do a feasibility study from ground up, do you find that that is a disaster or occasionally they get lucky?
Well, I'd say occasionally they get lucky, but usually, you know, there's a little self-policing that comes into play here. So if you're starting with a ground up development and then you're going to get a loan, the feasibility study is just a reverse appraisal. You know, you're basing this upon an expert's third party, you know, opinion based upon, you know, their experience and what they found, the stats in the market. And they're going to give either a green light, or a red light, or basically grade the site, you know, A plus, B minus, C minus, C plus, and then recommend going forward or not. And so the lender, your bank, your lender is going to require that. And if you are raising private equity on top of that, or for all of it, you know, they're going to want to see that as well. Not that it's just, you know, PK coming in and saying, hey, you know, we got a great site and it's fantastic because I listened to a radio show for an hour and now I'm an expert. Can you give me the money? You know, they want the data behind it. And so when you say get lucky, the only time somebody would get lucky is if they had cash and they decided to just roll the dice and build it, and, right, and it may work. But, you know, if they haven't gone through and done their homework, that's a risky venture.
So just because it's flat doesn't mean you build there.
That is correct.
Right. The other question PK has is what do you think? We talked a little bit about it, but is there an ideal customer client? And maybe as part of that feasibility study, what are you looking for clients and customers?
Yeah, well, see, we don't do, you know, we don't take an application, you know, so we're not trying to find people. But as far as the people that, you know, that are ideal are the ones that stay forever and they just take our price increases and never move. I mean, so I don't know how to quantify that any further you know, the people that don't, you know, come in and out a lot and you know, have a big traffic.
Let's maybe let's put it this way. So yeah, if I'm a multimillionaire living in a high income, you know, I'm living in a posh neighborhood, is that the market to rent my self storage?
Yeah, not necessarily, because you know what, they probably have a big enough house and they've got barns or, you know, pole barns and things like that to store. And so, you know, the demographic in where this works the most is usually a median income of around $50,000. That's a median income in a market, and then in a market where there is a lot of multifamily. So there's a whole lot of folks that have you know, that live in apartments. They have small houses. You know, the average housing size is small, and so we know there's going to be more of a demand. It's certainly growth is good, but even if it's a stagnant market, that's okay. And sometimes a declining market where people are moving out, as long as it's not, you know, they're not decimated by way of, you know, three, you know, large plants and employers moving out. But we're in the trauma and transition business. So even if there is a layoff or a plant closing, that's usually good for storage because then people are still staying in the market, but they're having to move back home or move in with each other. So they're really, you know, we're looking to the history of the competition, the folks around us, the history of the facility that we're looking to buy if it's an existing one, and one in which it can't be so rural, out way out in the middle of nowhere, in which none of those things that I just mentioned occur. But then also in the posh neighborhoods, it's going to cost a lot to build it, and it's going to be very difficult to build, and you're not going to get the clientele, the turnover, if you will, or the activity that you would like.
Gotcha. Okay. So As you look at that property too, at the, is there a price? So PK, another question is, what's the right price to buy it? So for instance, if I'm looking at a multifamily, I mean, multifamilies have just taken some crazy cap rate. And a cap rate, for those who are listening, don't know, is basically the rate at which if you put your capital in place at 100%, no financing, you're going to make that. So a cap rate, if I had a $100,000 investment in a property, I want an 8 cap rate. That means I want 8%. So that would be the property needs to produce $8,000 in income based on that. So what cap rates is the right price to be buying existing facilities or determining whether you build one?
Yeah. So I think PK is talking about land, and so I'll address that briefly first. And that is, you know, we paid $1 million for an acre, and we paid $60,000 for an acre. You know, it all depends upon the market and the rental rates. You know, on that $1 million an acre, that means I'm going up, you know, 4 or 5 stories, and so I can maximize that. And the rental rates in that market are obviously strong. And at the $60,000 rate, well, rents may be lower, but it all factors into my overall cost of buying the land and building the building and then doing the reverse engineering and the financial underwriting and the analysis. So don't get hung up on the cost of land until you really carry that out with the help of a consultant doing a feasibility study. So then, Scott, as you stated, when you're looking at an existing facility, I'm not trying to be coy, but, you know, it really doesn't matter because, you know, I bought facilities with a 0 to 1 or 2% cap rate, but, you know, they were only 40 or 50% occupied, you know, and they were 60% occupied, but there were mom-and-pop owners that never raised rates, and they never added any ancillary income streams, or they had an additional acre in which they could build upon that they never utilized. And so I can, you know, double the size or add 30% more rentable units to that. So I'm going to look at, obviously, at the cost and my return immediately when I buy it. But I'm more concerned with what does it look like a year down the road, 2 years down the road, 4 years down the road, once I've built additional units and stabilized it. So, you know, that being said, I don't get hung up on cap rate too much. But in today's environment, if you're looking at a traditional Class B self-storage facility, which is, you know, single story, run fairly well, but it's got some upside to it. Yeah, you can see that an 8% cap rate is about normal. If we're buying a Class C facility, we certainly want a little bigger spread because there's usually a heavier lift there, but usually needs a more of an upside and more of a gain and a profit on the back end. So we may be looking at the 8.5, 8.75. But with interest rates going down, you know, all those numbers are kind of out the window, so don't hang your hat on one particular number. And, you know, because it is a moving target and it depends on the facility. It always depends.
Do the lenders, you said SBA's got a good program, but other lenders, what do they look for, a cap rate? And I shouldn't say what do they look for.
Yeah.
They're really interested in the appraisal. So if somebody's going out and appraising the self-storage facility, what is the appraiser using to value that facility?
Yeah, they're having to go out a little bit farther because it's not like a neighborhood, you know, where there's usually one or 50, you know, of the same type of property that they can, you know, draw some averages from that have sold. But a storage facility, you know, they're all very unique and they're not very close. And so our appraisals, when it comes to comps, like type facilities, they can go several states over to find comps. So they will back it up with those comps in a region. But they're, again, they're looking more to the financials because that's, you know, just like multifamily and other commercial real estate, you know, the value of that facility is based upon the net operating income at a cap rate and then the overall condition of it. So there, it's a combination of, you know, well, you know, here's what we see right now where it's currently at, the T12, you know, the past 12 months, you know, P&Ls for the year. Here's what it looks like in a market cap rate that these have all sold have been at 6.75. And so here's a value we put on it. And they'll take in a few other things into consideration. Well, then when they come up with that value, how does that compare with the purchase price? And ultimately, then it's all about debt service coverage ratio. That's what the lender wants to know. They want a 1.15 to, you know, 1.3, depending upon the lender, debt service coverage ratio, meaning you have to have 1.25 times the amount of income coming in than the debt service to be able to make them feel comfortable going forward with a loan. So it's not so much, you know, the loan doesn't hinge so much on the appraisal. It hinges more on the debt service coverage ratio at the time you close.
So do the lenders, are they, do they get nervous? So if you bought one that you saw the great upside potential and you were getting a 1% cap rate, if I'm a lender, I'm going, well, that isn't going to work, right? The debt coverage ratio probably isn't going to work.
Right.
So how do they offset that when you get to the lenders?
They'll do a smaller LTV. You know, they may come in at a, you know, 40 or 50% LTV, and then we have to bring the rest of it with cash and or private equity, or it just may not be in their, you know, in their bailiwick. We may have to work out some other way with doing some seller financing or a seller carry back or, you know, buy it from them and then go to the lender after we've stabilized it. So, it really depends. In that case, we're usually just bringing more private equity or sometimes 100% of our own funds and private equity to buy it, and then we'll refinance it later once we've got it stabilized.
Great strategy. So we are going to take a break. The website is, the phone number, 877-772-9658. Call if you have any questions. We'll see you in a minute. Welcome back. I'm Scott Ellsworth, your host. Just wanted to remind you of venaradio@gmail.com for any questions or 877-772-9658. A couple upcoming events, the National Real Estate Investing Summit, which brought to you by Ohio Real Estate Investors Association. You can go to aureaconvention.com, aureaconvention.com. Scott Myers, who is our guest, is going to be speaking. It'll be a great session. You need to be there. That's here in Cincinnati. And then on 9:15, there's a webinar. It's a 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., so it'll be a Saturday. But if it's hot out, why not sit in your air conditioning and get some good information? All the ways to finance small investment properties. And you can go to CincinnatiREIA.com to register for that. So, Scott, we have one more. We have another question. So, again, it seems everybody has three parts to their, their questions.
They get their money's worth.
Yep. So Michael asks, how do you get started investing in self-storage?
Well, that's real simple. I think you just mentioned it, Scott. You go to the OREIA National Summit that is coming up, and we'll learn you all about storage, and you can also learn about other asset classes. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a number of ways to be able to learn, and that is joining a local club, getting immersed and involved in it. You know, we have an education arm, and so we teach people about self-storage, anything and everything self-storage. We've been doing it for over 20 years and produced literally hundreds of self-storage millionaires out there. There's a number of different resources online. Just be careful who you listen to and watch. I prefer some of the folks that have, you know, that have been out there in addition to myself that have, that write regular articles. And you can also get really solid information from the Self-Storage Association as well as Inside Self-Storage. Those would be the places to start if you want to take a focus on this asset class.
Yeah, you got to really be careful about the YouTube experts. Just a lot of that. I don't care what the topic is, whether it's self-storage, taxes, or what. You really need to vet that. And that is a good thing about the convention, the summit, is the fact that it's vetted. Vina does a great job of really working with the folks like you, Scott, to make sure that it's quality. It's good information. It's accurate. There's never a guarantee of results for any investor for any asset class. But we want to make sure that it's good education and then it's not something that is not. So the other question.
Hey Scott, can I make one public service announcement there as well? And you'll see that you know, Vina agrees with this. And if she doesn't say it at the front of the room at the summit, then I will. And that is, whether you're learning from somebody, investing alongside of someone, or investing passively in their deal as a, you know, through a self-directed IRA or a 401k, you really want to work with somebody who has been through a recession, like the Great Recession, or two. And anybody that you will see at the summit, we've all got grayer hair or less hair. We've been through a number of economic cycles now, and we can see a little further down the road. And you know, a phrase that I borrowed is, you would never want to learn from somebody or invest from somebody who hasn't been through some troubled times like a recession or two. In other words, this gentleman said, I would never invest with somebody. I would never follow a general into battle unless he walked with a limp. And there's a lot of truth in that. And, you know, we've got the scar tissue, you know, to prove and the wisdom that we have from it. So, yeah, just be careful. The folks that have done one or two or three deals, you know, since 2000 and in the past 5 or 6 years when they had, you know, the wind in their back of a great market.
Yeah.
So, choose your mentor, please.
Yeah, I have a real problem. To me, it's like I need, you know, somebody who says I've been successful in every single deal. I have not. I'm sure you have not. It's just there are, you know, that's life. That's part of investing.
Yeah.
And
right.
It's a matter of recovering and learning and trying not to repeat the same mistake. So I totally get it.
You ain't been doing a lot of business if you've never made a mistake.
Right. All right. So the other question, two questions I want to sort of combine. So he asks, how much is the investment, which really dovetails with the next one. How does an individual compete with you, Scott, or another big player when trying to make a purchase? That's really... So what's it take? Does that person need to have a bunch of money to get into this market, or are there other avenues for those funds to help make a purchase?
Well, I'd say first of all, it means that you need to avoid and just stepping away from, you know, you need to step it into an abundance mentality instead of one in which you feel there aren't enough deals around. And so, and I mean that with all peace and love. And that is, I've heard that many times. So I'm one guy, you know, there's 60 some thousand facilities out there. There's more than there are McDonald's and Starbucks and all these other businesses involved. So I can't do all the deals. And even all the students that we've taught over the years can't do all the deals. And we're not always looking at the same times. You know, we continue, you know, to this day you know, we just brought on another, I think a dozen or so folks into our mastery program. And almost half, there's just since three and a half months ago, and almost half of them already have deals, you know, under LOI, letter of intent, and or purchase agreements. And so there are so many reasons why people sell, the same reasons they always do in real estate, divorce, bankruptcy, trade in, trade up, it's depreciated. And so there's always people that are moving, but it doesn't mean that there's always people that are going, you know, there's 10 to 12 or 20 people for every storage facility that comes up for sale. That's just not the case. Otherwise, there wouldn't be people doing it if there weren't buyers for it. So that is not a mentality that you should adopt. It's just a fear mentality, and that there's a scarcity of deals out there, because it's nothing but an untruth. So you just got to hit your marks and go out there and execute.
So for instance, somebody who hasn't invested, which the questions were geared to that, is it better to start with a smaller project, like go find a, you know, a 50 unit, small units to start with, or do you go with the big ones and bring in the partners to help? What is the best strategy?
Yeah, I think somewhere in between, but at the end of the day, I think you try to buy the biggest one that you have available to you that you can get into. And here's why. Whether that's a limitation on your own cash, or if you decide that you want to bring in some private equity or some partners, joint venture partners, because those smaller facilities, you know, 50 units or below, it's just really tough to manage. You know, there's just not, you don't have the economies of scale of having a whole bunch of units and income to be able to then pay a manager, you know, part-time or a kiosk, and then, you know, pay for a third-party call center, you know, to handle the rest. You know, you don't have as many management dollars to handle it, so you have to do some of the work, some of the heavy lifting. You know, when you get up to the, you know, 400 units and 40,000 square foot facilities, well, that generates enough income that now you can put an operator in place, you know, that you oversee, that is operating the business, and now you have a marketing budget, so you're not having to do some of the marketing or all of the marketing. You know, you have a budget for that call center. You have a budget for a third-party company that may be able to fill some units up for you when you're not there to add the technology in. So that's as large of a facility as you can possibly buy within your own means, or that you feel comfortable in partnering with somebody, that makes the most sense. And by the way, those are the ones that are easier to get financed by a lender as well, because when they begin asking the questions of how you're going to manage it and there aren't many management dollars there, you know, that's where it's going to be difficult for them to, you know, get their heads around it and be able to grant you the loan.
Yeah, I've seen that in the residential side, or the commercial multifamily, that people buy units and they say they're just going to manage it themselves, and they're really, it's just not a great thing. I mean, you can manage yourself, but there's a cost to that. You know, they've got to do that, and I'm sure, and lenders generally assume that there's going to be some management cost, and if your pro forma doesn't have it, that's a problem.
It is. Yep. You stretched it to try to get this thing to work and get the debt service coverage ratio, but you didn't allow for management, and you said that you're going to, you know, plow snow and you're going to mow the lawn and you're going to clean and maintain the units. You know, that's just not realistic, and they'll see through that. And nor should you buy it then, if that's the case, if you're trying to make it work that way.
Right. I've had people who've done that, and they've come to me, and we've analyzed the deal for them for multifamily. And I'm like, you haven't included all these items. And they're like, I'm going to do it myself. I'm like, well, okay, then you're working for $12 an hour or $15 an hour.
You're right.
Whatever I said. Mm-hmm. I said, that's just a job. You own a job. So, how do you, the sort of last question before we end, how is self-storage performing versus other commercial assets? Do you think it's going to, I mean, like the next, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years, you know, what are the opportunities? How does it compare to the other classes? And any challenges coming up?
Yeah, you know, so I'm biased, and anybody who's been listening to us for the almost hour now, you know, I make it sound really rosy, like there's nothing that can go wrong. And there certainly, you know, there can be, and there are challenges in our industry. The headwinds that are facing us right now are the fact that many of the bigger players are buying up occupancy because they can. And so in some markets, they're coming in and developing a new facility, and, you know, they'll slash rates, and it makes it difficult for the rest of us because we have to match it for a while, and it takes a bit before we can then, you know, get our rates back up. So that's, I think, maybe the current challenge that we're seeing right now. However, we're tempering that with the fact that we're gaining some unwanted attention in our industry, and if we're not careful, we may see ourselves in a place where there's rent control if we start to have some, if we're portrayed as bad actors and continue to do so. So a little self-policing going on there, but that's just kind of one of the challenges that I see right now. You know, there's always a chance that a market will be oversupplied for a little while. And so, everybody likes to say, oh, well, gosh, I see these storage facilities going up everywhere, and this country must be oversaturated with those. And well, first of all, oversaturated is a, it's a double negative. So that means that there's a great opportunity, but I get it, saturated. And we may see that for a time in certain markets in which they're popular. And so some developers come in and they maybe get a little over anxious, even go beyond, a little over their skis in terms of, going beyond what the feasibility study states. But then there's almost always a leveling off. We're still undersupplied in this country compared to, all the demographics and what we see in terms of how people utilize storage. There's just a glut. There's a need for it. And we also go through these cycles when the lenders put their pencils down, like we see right now and heading into an election year and a potential recession, that then there's a leveling off of that. And so for every season in which everything is great and there's a little bit of a, maybe overbuilding or it's competitive, that's usually tempered very quickly by a season in which there's more of a demand for it.
All right.
So I see no end in sight for the demand for storage and the multiple uses, but that's what I see right now.
All right. Well, Scott, you have been an awesome guest. I hope everybody learned a lot. We thank you so much for being on the show tonight, and we'll talk to everybody next week.